we are now recording. If anybody's having a challenge and you're on the telephone line, you're having trouble getting on Ustream, please let us know. I'm going to start the recording here in a moment. That'll open it up. If there's a challenge, then we'll all be on the telephone tonight. But you can reach us this evening during the call by texting. I'm going to go ahead and start the record now. Bear with me just for a moment.
Okay, I'll be on mute.
Okay, we've got the Ustream going now. If some of you are on the call, you might try it and see if you're able to get on right now. We're not showing anybody on that call, so we might be having a technical challenge this evening with the video streaming. If that's the case, please let us know. It looks like we're live. We have sound going out. And it says we've got the channel up and recording, so hopefully we'll be okay. Those of you on the call or just text me at 801-541-9181 if we're having a challenge with the Ustream this evening. I know we were looking at upgrading to a little better service that we can use on Facebook as well, and I'm just wondering if we might have pushed the wrong button tonight. I apologize if that's the case, but welcome. We'll have a great time whether it's on the telephone or whether it's live on the video tonight, so welcome. I'm going to look into the camera as if we're on the video, so here we go. We're on record, we're on mute, and we're ready for our Tuesday night call. We want to welcome all of those who are with us for the first time. Every Tuesday night we get together for what we call a celebration of life. This is an opportunity for us to explore principles, foundational principles that will direct our lives, guide our lives, help us get up and out of the dungeons of confusion so that we can see opportunity more clearly and move forward with our lives. It looks like we're getting a text message. What's the word, sweetheart?
Ruth is saying can't get in, so I assume she's talking Ustream.
Okay. It sounds like the Ustream is having a challenge. I'm going to go ahead and turn off the Ustream and stop the broadcast and restart it again and see if that can help us out. So bear with me just for a moment while we do that. There's always a possibility that there's a little bit of a challenge, so just one moment, everyone. Thank you for your patience. Okay, it looks like we're back live on the Ustream. Let me put on broadcast and see if that helps. Bear with me for a moment. According to our side, we're now broadcasting and now recording on the Ustream, so I hope that is the case. If you can't get on the Ustream, just stay with me on the telephone, and we'll have a good experience this evening. I mentioned a moment ago that we spend every Tuesday night talking about these foundational principles, and we cycle through what we call the six qualities of an intentional creator. These are foundational principles for our lives, and tonight, for those of you who are with us for the first time and visiting, this is the beginning of a process that takes us about 10 weeks. We cycle through these six qualities about every 10 weeks. Sometimes we spend 2 or 3 weeks on a single quality because of the importance, which is true, of quality number one, the art of connection. So let's begin. Tonight we start with the art of connection, then we'll move to mental creation, how to use our mind constructively, because our mind is very busy. I don't know about you, but in the last week I know there have been many times when my mind is wanting to go over into those dark dungeons of despair or discouragement because of one reason or another. There's lots going on in all of our lives. We just say, not going there today. I'm going to stay in creation. And when we do, we find out things maybe weren't as bad as we thought they might be, or we found new ideas. This is how we create when there are this many firestorms raging in the world, many not of our own making. So mental creation. Then we move to physical creation, where we bring the passion that we received from having this clear vision of possibility, and we bring it into the here and now, and we act. We do the work of creation, of physical creation. We mentally create it in our mind. Now we physically create in reality that which we saw so clearly in our mind. Quality four, we take on those pesky thought processes that want us to resist and resent and rebel to keep us from being structured and disciplined. And then we take on quality five, finding joy in the journey, which helps us to turn relationships into partnerships and to find gratitude, to manage sorrow, and to find joy, and manage our time, and find meaning and purpose in our life. Then lastly, quality number six, self-esteem, where we find out what causes challenges in self-esteem. I had an opportunity today to have some wonderful exchanges with my agent. As many of you know, we're working on the book, and I finished a draft and sent it to her, finally. It's a couple of months overdue, and she came back and said, Dave, you know, I want you to take a couple of these stories a little deeper. In the world in which we're living, people really need to know, one, that you've been there, and two, your life experience of digging out of the darkness so that they know, one, that it's possible, and two, how to do it, that you can use your life in proxy for all of those who will be reading. And so we're going back now through the manuscript and going a little bit deeper. I was pondering one of those experiences today. In the book, we talk about what happened in 1988 and 89 when the Tax Reform Act was passed, and we were in the middle of a very wet winter, and we were in the middle of a construction of a beautiful apartment complex, Ventana del Pueblo in Escondido, and it was just a mess. I mean, everything was a mess. Everything was underwater. It seemed like we had subcontractors going bankrupt left and right, underground, framing, plumbing, drywall. They would get partially done and go bankrupt. These were substantial contractors. It was just an awful time in Southern California for construction. We finally finished the building. And our lives were a mess. It was a very difficult and challenging time. Ramona and I and our children had a beautiful home in Mount Helix, and we had all the trappings. And we had the house built in, tennis coach to go with the tennis court, and exotic sports cars, and Mercedes, and housekeepers, and it was in a 40-foot custom Bluebird motorhome sitting out in the Circle Drive. It was a wonderful life, except for it wasn't real anymore, at least the income to support this. And I remember in the last apartment building, this is what I've been reflecting on this afternoon, this last apartment building, we had finished it. We got our conditional use permit, your ability to move people in. We're filling it up. We own the management company. It's all coming together. And in the lowest building, it was built tiered on a hillside. In the lowest building, we kept having backups in the sewer. In the farthest two apartments from where the line came out of the building, and I went, oh my goodness, we've got a problem here. We'd lost several hundred thousand dollars in construction of this building as it was falling apart, the construction effort. We didn't have a construction company really left. We had the management company. And the task for fixing this fell upon me. Now, I learned how to work really hard when I was young. I worked for a landscape company, Terry Byers. And Terry would have me come to work at 6 o'clock in the morning. And we would outline the job. He'd drop me off, and I would work, and he'd drop by at noon. He worked for DuPont during the daytime, and then he'd come back at 5 o'clock, and we'd work late into the night. And I still remember the day that I said, Terry, I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said, you know, you're only supposed to work 8 hours a day, 5 days a week. That's 40 hours. And I was working 16 hours a day, 6 days a week. And I thought, you know, he said something about getting time and a half. And when I was making $1.75 an hour back then, I thought time and a half would be pretty cool. And Terry said it this way. He said, Dave, tell you what. I'm going to divide the day in half. Would you like the morning or would you like the afternoon? I'll just hire somebody else. Or, if you'd like, you can have both days, both halves of the day. Which would you prefer? That first half or the second half, or you can have both halves if you like them. Well, I took both halves. We never talked about time and a half ever again. I would imagine now he would be in violation of some serious law, but back then I was just happy for the work. I learned how to work hard in that landscape business, and I remember this moment in time. It's a beautiful home, driving a Mercedes. I would load my rubber boots and these clothes that would allow me to stand ankle deep in human excrement in a trench that was 100 feet long and 3 feet deep, drive up to Escondido and work on this mess. I still remember the moment I opened up the line. Ugh, it's just disgusting. It reminds me of Shawshank Redemption when he's climbing through the pipe to freedom, except for I wasn't on my hands and knees, just standing in it was bad enough. I remembered that moment. I was the last one standing. And it wasn't too long after that that we just closed everything down. We lost millions. And we owed $1 million. Those were the corporate lines of credit. Everything we could do to finish the project, to keep our lifestyle going, the staff, we had to let everybody finally go, and it was just a devastating time. And I still remember the day we loaded everything into those two Ryder trucks and we're pulling out of the driveway, and I'm looking back at our dream home. Now, this home I had seen 15 years earlier, 10 years before we purchased it. I said to Ramona, we're going to own that home. We're going to own that home. It wasn't a fantasy. And I worked very hard to create the money to buy that home. And now we were driving away. We barely sold it before we would have lost it. And I'm bawling. I don't mind telling you. And there's Ramona in our Ford van with our seven children singing camp songs. Huge difference between the way the two of us looked at that experience. But we came to Utah and began to rebuild. I won't go into detail about that experience. It's detailed in the book. But the point is this for today's discussion. During this next 10 years, I would learn some extremely valuable lessons. I had a very traumatic night in which my very proud heart, and it was very proud, was ripped out. And God began the process of a heart transplant. And at the very core, of this heart transplant was a principle. And the principle was most seek to have abundance. That's where we've been for the last decade even. Instead, seek to become abundant. When we seek to have abundance, it's all about, when I seek to have abundance, it's all about me. When I seek to become abundant, it's all about others. I'm reading a chapter or paragraph in the book. It says, I was instructed to focus on becoming abundant in the very fibers of my being. I was promised that as I focused on this fundamental principle, doors would open and blessings would flow. And that was true. If I desired riches, I could aggressively pursue riches, but only with the intent of lifting and building others and contributing to the world. I was instructed to use these riches to create value everywhere I went. I was to become a creator that would enrich the world, not a taker that would rob the world. Furthermore, abundance was not something I was to seek to win. It was not something I was to seek to receive. It was a sacred process in which I was to actively participate and eventually become. This was the beginning of the principles that now guide this quality called the art of connection. The art of connection, at the very core of us connecting with others, is that it's no longer about us. It is about others. And what are the gifts? What do we receive when this happens? What are the blessings that come to us? I've outlined these very clearly in the material. I can kind of review them with you. One, as we partner with the force of creation itself and bringing abundance to the lives of others, there is something that happens in our experience, in terms of our perception of where we fit in this world. As we use our mind constructively and we get inspired ideas and we act on those ideas, even when it's dark, and I mentioned some principles in the book that sometimes we doubt our own inspiration in moments of darkness, and that miracles are only miracles in retrospect. I remember, some of you might know the Goodman family. CBS did a special, had the privilege of writing and directing the television special for them. It's a wonderful video. The Goodman family had several children, got into an automobile accident. They were singing around the world, by the way, and the UN and other places. And three of their children were killed one Sunday in an automobile accident. And they continued to sing, and we did this special on them. And Claudia wrote a book. And she came to me one day and said, "Dave, would you help me identify the title?" And imagine losing three of your children in an automobile accident as you're driving somewhere as a family. Two cars, one of them got hit broadside. And all of a sudden your dreams of singing around the world are shattered, and then you pull it all back together, and the next thing you know, you are with what's left. She said, "What should I call this book?" And so I made a prayerfully considered possibilities. I came back to her with two titles. I said, "There are two titles. One, maybe you ought to call it Parting the Red Sea, One Bucket at a Time." Because sometimes that's how it feels when you're working on these miracles. And the other title was Miracles Are Only Miracles in Retrospect. She chose the first one, and I talk about the second one in my book, because the miracles that occurred in Ramona's and my life and the life of our children are absolutely astounding. However, when we're in the middle of the darkness, in the middle of the battle, it doesn't look at all like a miracle. It only looks like a miracle in retrospect. So learning these principles, now we're ready to step into people's worlds. We're ready to connect and serve them. And as we use our mind constructively, we get these ideas and we act on them. Retrospectively, we see the miracles. In the moment, we can feel ourselves fully using our gifts. Now, when we procrastinate, we don't use our gifts. We're covering them. They're under a sham, like a pillow sham. It's of shame. It's covering us up. It's holding us back. We're not using our gifts. But when we fully use our gifts, we get to meet ourselves. This happens when we stop procrastinating. We jump in to do a task. Anybody been there and gone, "Wow, that wasn't so hard. Wow, why'd I wait so long?" The truth is, our genius just showed up. We got to meet who we really are, our gifts. And as we embrace our goodness, and we act on our own moral authority, doing the right thing for the right reason, because we want to and get to and choose to, when we do this, we also get to meet our own divine nature as a human being. And when all of this starts to happen, the ultimate gift that we're given from focusing on others and in their service, and using our creativity to come with better and better ideas to serve, and we use all of our gifts in that service, all of those pieces help us better understand who we are. Bottom line is, we get to meet our true self. Our self-esteem heals. Isn't that a great thing? That we get to meet ourselves. So as we go into this discussion tonight about the art of connection, and we say, well, the art of connection at the very foundation of this is that it's not about us. It never was about us. Wow, I'm not sure that's what I want to do. Well, if we don't, we're going to spend a lifetime trying to fill a very empty hole in our soul, which will never be filled by going inward in search of who we are. We find ourselves by going outward in the service of others. That's when these other pieces happen. It creates the laboratory, if you will, for this experiment to occur. And we get to meet ourselves. What a great gift to finally know who we are. We haven't given anything, really, in the end. We end up gaining everything. So if you want to find yourself, lose yourself in the service of others. That may sound like a very familiar quote to some. So let's walk through some of these principles. As we start to contemplate this concept of connection with other people, the very first thing we're going to notice is that everybody's living in their own little cocoon. Everybody's worried about their own stuff. I say everybody, categorical, it's most. It's the vast majority, so I'll just say all for right now. Vast majority are living in their own cocoon, dealing with their own crap. We've got our own, what we call a wall of resistance. It's actually been measured. The scientist, Dr. Hartman, who did the mathematics for our intentional creation assessment, measured this. He discovered that on average, in a non-adversarial relationship, that's between two committed companions, two dear friends, two coworkers that love working together, in this non-adversarial and relatively stress-free environment, a person holds back. I just want you to vision this. Vision this wall around them, and behind the wall, imagining them holding back 40%, on average, 40% of their cooperation and their productivity. That's a lot of cooperation productivity to be holding back. So the very first thing in connection with people, we're going to want to imagine that everyone we meet has a wall of resistance. And we can in our excitement, enthusiasm, anybody on the phone? I know we're on mute and we can't hear, but you can scream out, yep, me, I did it, in our enthusiasm, to share an idea or a business opportunity or something we're excited about. We go and throw up all over somebody, blah, blah, blah. And just imagine, now you know what's going on. There's a wall, so when you throw up, it's just splashing off the wall. What we project splashes back. It's called rejection. It tastes terrible. And we quite often get frustrated and sometimes even angry. It's like, this is so easy to see. I mean, an idiot could get, what is wrong with you? Why can't you understand? You can feel all that anxiety. Anybody been there? Had that kind of a feeling? Well, now you know why. You weren't talking to the person. You were talking to their wall of resistance. You have one. When was the last time somebody called you at an inopportune time and tried to sell you a vacuum cleaner or something, and you just said, take me off your list, and you hang up the phone, and we hold back 100% of our cooperation in a situation like that. And the truth be known, that when you approach someone who is not a close friend, who's not a committed companion, because they're holding back 40% on average, somebody else may be holding back 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, maybe 100% behind the wall. If this is true, throwing up on the wall is not going to do any good. Now, many of us have tried it. And there's another option. If we're not throwing up, there are some who try to take down these walls with metaphorical sledgehammers. that coercion and manipulation, that clever sales technique, that secret whatever. There's manipulative tools. And Og says, muscle can split a shield and even destroy life. We can swing that sledgehammer. But only the unseen power of love, agape love, a heightened level of awareness, only this will open the hearts of men. And until I master this art of connection, I'm no more than a peddler in the marketplace. I still remember a coaching call. I was writing about this just yesterday. Got a client that said, she happened to be in network marketing, and she had an upline who was, frankly, a sledgehammer-wielding leader. And it worked for this person, and he believed it worked for him, it should work for everyone. So he was teaching his people how to use these coercive, manipulative techniques to talk to people. And she went, well, it's prior to our coaching. I guess if that's the way it's supposed to be done, I'll try it. So she violated her own empathy and tried it. In the coaching session, she said, you know, I just felt so icky. I wanted to take a shower. Isn't that interesting? If we throw up on someone, we feel the rejection, we take it personally. We go in, if it's not our nature to use a sledgehammer, we are going to feel like a peddler in the marketplace. If it doesn't bother us to do that, we ought to be really concerned. There's a little bit of an antisocial personality involved in that process, I sense, without being a clinician and making a diagnosis, of course. But there is a way. There is a way to get this wall down that almost everybody can do. In our assessment of thousands and thousands of people, we've discovered that the vast majority of people who are in a position where they want to persuade someone, they want to convince someone, they may even need to recruit them into their vision or dream. And that's almost all of us. Whether we're trying to talk somebody into going on a date with us when we're single, or whether we're trying to bring somebody into a business, that 98% of the people have a very high level of empathy. Six measurements in their assessment. If you want to write these down, it's empathetic, respectful. Let's write that down. Empathetic, respectful, accepting, tolerant, just and fair, and compassionate. These six characteristics, for the most part, they're very clear. Now, I was sharing with someone today, I said, I want you to imagine a vein of gold is 2 feet long, it's 4 inches in diameter, and it weighs 100 pounds. It might weigh more than that, it might weigh 200 pounds. Gold's very heavy. Now, if it weighed 200 pounds and gold is selling for, what, $1,400 an ounce, that's a lot of money. That's 1,600 ounces. Matter of fact, it's 3,200 ounces. You know, you're talking about lots and lots of money. This is very valuable. And this is like looking at this vein of gold, these empathetic measurements. We have them, but where are they? Do we have them available to us? Can we see this vein of gold, if you will? The truth is, for most of us, we pile a lot of dirt on top of it. If you look at your intentional creation assessment on the right-hand side, there are several thought processes that are generally getting in the way. We create expectations about how we'd like life to be. We sometimes dislike our life because it's not showing up as fast as or equal to. We start blaming ourselves and doubting our ability and questioning our beliefs and even sometimes our worth. We get impatient and frustrated. And what's this? It's just like taking one pile of dirt after another. Okay, another shovel full. Pretty soon you can't see the gold. We don't even know it's there. Sometimes we'll even forget. And part of the process that we'll go through tonight and next week is to take some of that dirt. Let's clean it off. Let's start to use these gifts. Now, at first, we won't do it perfectly. But just know that the instant you start to do what I share with you tonight, you become very rare. Very rare. It's like gold is rare. No matter how poorly you do it, it may be the best experience this person's ever had. So this isn't about perfection. This is about starting the process. So we start with the fact that everybody has a wall. Everybody see it? I want you this week, while you're walking around, when you're excited to talk to someone, to say, oops, they've got a wall. Now, I can throw up on that wall. It's an option. It's going to splash back. I'll feel rejection. And I'll have my feelings hurt. Or two, I can pull out my metaphorical sledgehammer and take a few whacks at it and try to break through. Or I can start to use this agape love that the dog talks about, because that's where we're headed tonight. And this is a very natural thing for almost everyone. I'm emphasizing that because it's so important for us to know that we're going to use a natural strength, sometimes covered with dirt, but a beautiful natural strength. So, what are these thought processes, this empathy, this intuition, these six thoughts? Empathy, by its very definition, is the ability to put ourselves on the path of another person, to see something through their eyes, free of bias and prejudice. What a wonderful thing to do. What allows us to stay there and connect is our intuition, our inner sense of knowing. and our intuition helps us pull on our own life experiences, those things that have happened to us, and quite often those most painful things. And with those experiences, we get to show up uniquely prepared. I was recently talking in Atlanta, and I shared the story that's in the material. And since we have so many guests on the phone tonight who do not have their studio, don't have access to this material, I'm going to go ahead and tell you the story. I'm going to do it tonight in a way, I hope, that all, whether you've heard it or not, can perhaps look at your lives a little differently. Because there are so many people right now that are in such pain. Some of you on the phone are feeling it. And we don't get to the bottom of our pain by going inward. We get to the bottom of our pain by serving, by going outward. It's amazing what happens. So let's talk about how to do this. I want you to go with me to Chicago. This is about almost 5.5 years ago now. And I was speaking, and I was going to speak the next morning. And I was lying in bed and pondering the speech as I normally do, vividly visualizing the people and what would be important for them to know. And I began to reflect on some of the challenges that people might be having in their lives. I had assessed a number of these people. They'd taken assessments, and I debriefed them. So I knew a fair amount about a couple of hundred of them. Another 500, I just made some assumptions that they were probably in very similar circumstances. And I went to sleep. And I woke up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'd had this amazing, vivid dream. Has anybody on the phone just ever had a vivid dream where you just woke up and went, wow, what was that all about? And I was just lying in bed, as I'm sure you have, and just reflecting on it, replaying it, thinking through it. What was that? What did that mean? Well, I'm going to share with you the dream. Because in this dream, I'm walking on a path, and it was just a single path. And I remember over my right shoulder, I've got both my hands wrapped around this sack, this big muslin, this white muslin sack is draped over my right shoulder, and it's dragging on the ground behind me. And I'm dragging this, it's heavy. And I knew what was in it. It was all of my living nightmares, my failures, my disappointments, discouragements. If you've got a paper and pen handy, just pull it out for a moment and just write, my sack. You might even write, I wonder what's in my sack. What am I dragging around? It's very symbolic that it was behind me. These are things I didn't really want in my life, but they were part of my life. I couldn't let them go. I had to drag them around. But they were in the past. I'm dragging them. Well, I approached this man. He's walking on the path toward me. And I wanted to connect with him. And I knew the principles of connection. And I was exhausted. And I didn't have a lot of energy. And all of a sudden, this voice said to me, let go of the sack. I let go of it, and I stood up tall. Oh, such a relief not to have that sack. And I looked at the man, and just before I started to connect with him, I was told to turn around. So I turned around to look at the sack. Didn't really want to. I mean, I'd been avoiding it. It was behind me for a reason. And then I was told to empty the contents of the sack. And I'm very aware that some on the phone tonight may have some things in their sack that are so painful to look at, you can't. Before I go any further, I just want you to know that if you have some of those things in your sack, get some assistance from a therapist. Let them help you process what's in the sack. Because as long as we're dragging our past around behind us, we really can't connect with people. We'll just go through the motions. We'll be frustrated, angry. We'll throw up on people's walls. We might even try to take down those walls with sledgehammers. You just can't connect. Not as long as you're dragging a lot of stuff around. So if you have any challenges with this, what I share with you tonight, don't be offended by anything I share, please. Don't feel inadequate or less than. Because some people have had some really awful things happen in their lives, and they've been very painful. When I was told to empty this sack, I was then asked to pick up the one item that was the most painful, the most awful. For me, that experience had happened in Chicago about 52 years before that. I was between the ages of 2 and 4. My father was going to school in Chicago and working at night. I don't know how he made it through those years. Very little sleep. My mother, who grew up on a farm in Amalga, Utah. I mean, there's not even a gas station or a drugstore in Amalga. She was now working in a high-rise in bustling Chicago. I mean, it was like, you know, almost, well, it did. She had some challenges with that. It was very difficult for her. And there was this couple, Alan and Rose. And Alan and Rose decided they wanted to befriend my sister and me. They came to my parents. They couldn't have children, and they loved children, and they knew that my parents just didn't have very much and needed help, and they really wanted to be of service. Interesting, huh? I mean, today, wouldn't we go, that's a little odd. But back in 1955, 56, 57, those years, you know, it was just a godsend. I mean, wow. This could take some pressure off of us. I mean, we're living in a one-bedroom apartment, like on the third story with no elevator. And no joke, you know, Murphy bed comes out of the wall. We cooked with a popcorn popper. I mean, that's what we cooked our meals in. I've been told. I was 2 to 4. I don't remember that, but that was what I've been told. It was really an awful time, a lot of sacrifice. And this was just such a wonderful thing. This couple befriended my sister and me, and they would take us out on outings, and they'd buy gifts for us. And when Christmas time came, Santa Claus would come to our apartment and shower us with gifts. Wonderful things. Challenge. Challenges, they were pedophiles. Now, it'd be more obvious today than then. And when everything was done and we're moving from Chicago, these two monsters had taken far more than they ever gave. I'm reflecting on this thing, looking at it, and then I'm told, you know, don't go back and relive any of those experiences, because those were not pleasant. But remember how you felt as a result of the experience. You know, if you've ever had a loss, one of those difficult moments in your time, in your life, and maybe you've lost a job, or you've lost a house, or a relationship, or maybe a companion, or a child, or it's not how big it is. It's just how it felt to have that sense of loss. What did you feel like? What impact has it had on your life since? That's what I was asked to examine. And I was told to do something really strange that I'm going to share with you tonight. And this is why I preface this with, if you're having a challenge, you're going to want to talk to a professional to process through this. If it's hard to look at, if it's hard to pick it up, don't do it tonight. Just be okay with this discussion. But if you can, pick it up. What is yours? On that big pile of stuff on the floor, these were silver orbs with spikes on them. Kind of symbolic. What is yours? Do you know what it is? Do you know? If you do, pick it up and just hold it in your hand. And just ask, what price have I paid since this event? How many hours of sleep have I lost? What kind of angst has this created? Even anger. What has this done to my relationships and my ability to be comfortable around people? What has this done? You got one in your hand? I'm holding mine in my hand again, just looking at it. And I was asked to take it and put it against my chest and press it, engrave it on my heart. Well, I'm thinking these spikes are going to burn, you know? And it didn't. It just slid right into my heart. I'm thinking, what is this? And I was asked to pick up the next one, and then the next one, and do likewise, until they were all in my heart. I was surprised. And I want to tell you, you'll be surprised too. Because when we're dragging these things around our sack, it's exhausting. Ugh. And all of a sudden, we're putting them in our heart. And when we put these thoughts in our heart, these experiences in our heart, our heart just expands. And we're finally free. I tried to explain what this was like. And all I could call it was ownership. It's like I now owned me. This is part of my life. I'd always wanted to be someone else, somewhere else, doing something different. I didn't want that stuff that was in that sack. But it was my life. And by putting it in my heart, all of a sudden it was like I had found part of me. I'd been lost. I'd been sitting back in this sack being dragged around by this hollow figure of a person. What are you dragging around? What are you holding? Grave it on our hearts. Because when I finished doing this, the voice said, turn back around and face this man. So I did. I turned around. There he was. And that's when it made all the sense in the world. The sense was that for the first time, I noticed that he, too, was dragging a sack. And interestingly, I knew what was in it. I could feel it. I stepped into his world. I knew the questions to ask. Nobody needed to give me a script. I didn't need to tell him what had happened to me and all this trouble and strain and millions of dollars lost. Didn't need to say anything. All of that in my heart helped me feel what he was feeling because I knew what it felt like to have that experience. And knowing what it felt like, I was able to ask him questions. When that happened, did you ever feel this way? Oh, yeah. Until he knew that I knew where he was. Didn't need to fix him. He finally felt understood. Stephen Covey makes this comment. He talks that understanding is to the heart what water is to the body, or air is to the body. It's like breathing. To be understood, it feels so wonderful, the gift that somebody gives us when they understand they didn't need to fix us. Well, I've pondered this dream a lot since. And I stumbled into a couple of issues privately, and I want to share them with you because you may be struggling with them or could struggle with them as well. Because this is such a key piece in connection with people. Because once we take all that stuff out of the sack, we put it into our hearts, and we show up caring about people, noticing, we start going through the six qualities of or six principles of intrinsic validation. If we own this experience, we are so uniquely prepared, and the force of creation puts people on our path who we can serve. Uniquely, we can serve. It's powerful. We start to see miracles in our lives that can't come any other way. And the biggest challenge I found was this. I didn't frame it this way in the first edition of the book, but I'm going to, because it's the truth. Ramona could testify. Oh, I've never heard Ramona complain about anything. That's probably all she ever hears from me when I'm tired. Ah. When we're dragging this stuff around in our sack, and somebody says, well, why don't you wear it in your heart and show up okay? No problems. It's not about you anymore. It's about them. You get to use all of this experience. You know, I wonder if anybody else is having this experience. All of a sudden, all kinds of people are put on our path, and we're connecting with them. Walls are coming down. Cooperation and productivity is flooding out. Our businesses are beginning to flourish. Miracles are happening in our lives. Every once in a while, we're going to go, man, but that stuff I had in my sack really hurt. I want people to know how much it hurt. What about all those hours and all that sacrifice and all that suffering? Nobody's ever going to know. You want me to let go of all of that? Well, yeah. And here's the principle. Nobody cares. Nobody cares. Now, it's not that they don't want to care. It's back to the wall. This was the secret of success Og's been trying to teach us. Everybody's behind their own wall with their own stuff, dragging their own sack, preoccupied. The one who wins, the greatest secret of success in all ventures, is for the person who empties their sack, engraves the contents on their heart, and shows up okay. No more victimhood, No more complaining, no more suffering, no woe is me, and oh, it's been a long day, I've worked so hard, la 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 la. We're showing up for others. Not in self-sacrifice. Not as, oh, I guess I got to give everything. It's not that kind of energy. It's showing up happy and joyful. And when we do, walls come down. We connect with people. And that cooperation and productivity that we desperately need to succeed pours out to us. We're the beneficiary. Would we trade the woe is me, the weeping and complaining that Og talks about in scroll number 3, which is so contagious? Would we sacrifice that to get a 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90% cooperation and productivity from others? Would we trade the need to whine for abundance? Of course we would. However, I still remember some moments when I wanted to go back and just have my pity party. Matter of fact, somebody asked me that today. Have you ever wanted to have a pity party? I said, yeah. You just learn after a while that what's the value? What do you really get out of it? You get to waste some time and suck the energy out of everybody else. And they barely have enough energy to drag around their own sack, let alone give us what we need. The secret is we show up in service to them, giving them what they need, and their walls come down and we're the beneficiary. This is an exciting thing to know. I hope I'm communicating this in a way that maybe for the first time, if you've heard this before, it's making more sense than ever before. Because when I say it's not about us, it's about them. It's not about me, it's about others. Wow. I mean, I have to sacrifice? No. We just get to look at it differently. We get to see it for what it is. We get to have agape love, which is Greek, and it means a heightened level of awareness. We get to rise above bias and prejudice. We get to see people and give them the right to have their ideas and their opinions without taking it personally. We don't need to fix them. We don't need to be right. We don't have an agenda. We don't have baggage. We're finally free. Our self-esteem heals, and we get to find the joy that comes in that service and the peace of mind. Well, everybody's got a wall. Empathy, intuition is how we take it down. Take a look at your assessment of those 6 measurements: empathetic, respectful, accepting, just and fair, loyal, and compassionate. These are like lenses that we put on. And when we put them on, are we seeing people accurately? Can we trust the impressions that we get? Of the ones I've mentioned, the most common lens, it's a little foggy, is respectful. We're going to focus a little too much on how people look outwardly. That can create 2 challenges. One, we'll create expectations about how they might perform based on how they look. Or 2, we might be a little intimidated and feel a little uncomfortable around people who look successful. You might consider, if you've got a chicken list, those people you'd like to talk to about your business. You're just uncomfortable talking to them. Why? Well, they look successful. There has never been a time that I can remember in all of my professional life where there was such a difference between how people look and the real realities of their life. Walls have never been higher, but they've never been thinner. And those who care to really listen, if you say, yeah, but Dave, I've had some real challenges. My money situation is really awful. I go, isn't this great? Isn't this great? You absolutely know what it feels like to lose. You may not have had to make millions to lose it. You may not have lost your wife and daughter to alcoholism like Og. Our good friend Michelle Eborn, who might be on the call tonight, Michelle, who lost her husband, Gwen Peterson, and her put together this wonderful program for widows. You may not be like our friend Chad Hymas, who was on the call with us last Wednesday night with John Maxwell and Harvey McKay and Kevin Hall. You may not be a quadriplegic. You may not have had your spine crushed. But you've had experiences, and those experiences have uniquely prepared you for connection. So with that in mind, I'd like to take the last few minutes and begin the process of sharing the qualities, the principles of intrinsic validation. Intrinsic means deep, personal. We're going to value a human being for their contributions, their appearance, for their ability, for their uniqueness, their pricelessness. They're going to know that we know where they are and we didn't need to fix them, persuade them, sell them, manipulate them. We just honored their right to be on this planet. That's the gift we give them. And there are six principles that we follow to create this level of connection with a human being. And I might tell you that most decisions today, buying houses, insurance, especially major investments, business changes, different approaches to business, these are made at this level. They're made behind this wall. Truth is, we can send somebody back behind that wall to make that decision, and they get to wallow in all their own thought processes that are in their sack. Or we get to walk in there with them and help them navigate. Chances are they'll make a better decision if they're with them. So this is a time in history where knowing how to get beyond somebody's wall and be in their world with them and create a safe place is not just a nice idea. It's not a soft skill. It's imperative. It's a requirement. It's a hard fact. If we want our businesses to flourish, this is where we're going to want to be. So let's start taking a look. The very first thing, we want to start noticing people. Ramon and I were watching the movie again the other day, Avatar. I love that line, I see you. It has such deep meaning. I see you. It's like namaste. I salute the divine within you. I see your goodness. I see your value. I don't just see you. I really see you. It's almost like I feel you. This is the first principle. We want to be able to start noticing what is important to other people. What's important to them? Can we notice? Not if we're dragging around our sack. Not if we're in our pity party. Not if we're overwhelmed. Not if we're in that dungeon of despair and discouragement. We're not going to notice what's important to someone else. Not unless it's so glaring. So we want to step outside of our own wall. Our wall. Walk out. Start building a bridge to a person. And we're going to build that bridge by starting to notice what's important to them. I was writing again about this week in the book, telling a little bit more about this story than I had ever told before. Because we're up at a couples retreat. And it was winter. And the day before this event occurred, we were on a snowmobile trip. And we went to Hardware Ranch, where there's an elk preserve, and we took a sleigh ride amongst the elk. It's pretty amazing, because as long as you stay in the sleigh, you go right up like within 10 feet of them, and there's a 6-point elk sitting there on the grass. Gorgeous, fabulous, what a sight. Well, on the way there, we're going down this road, and we had the couples two up with the wives driving. I thought that was always fun. We were talking about trust. And to have the guy on the back with their wife driving, or their committed companion driving, and this one couple took a corner a little too fast, went up over the berm and hit a tree. Fortunately, nobody was hurt. But that was the event of the previous day. That night, we came back to the cabin and we all climbed in the jacuzzi and the lake was frozen. So we watched the moon rise, because it rises over there on the east side of the lake and it shines on this frozen lake. It's just fantastic. And we're sitting in the jacuzzi looking at this. And this young man who was the one who was in the snowmobile crash, I noticed that on his forearms there was a tattoo, three of them. And the same tattoo was on his other forearm, and the same tattoo was on his chest, the same tattoo was on his back. Now, I thought that was kind of interesting. Why would he have the same tattoo in those four places? I remember thinking about it. I thought, wow, I'm going to have to ask him about this. It didn't seem to be appropriate when we're out there in the jacuzzi laughing and talking. But the next morning, we were talking about how we could connect with our companions more effectively by seeing what was important to them and noticing it. And I turned to him and I said, would you be willing to share with us the significance of your tattoos? And some other people in the room joined and said, oh, yeah, yeah. I wasn't the only one who noticed. His face lit up, just lit up. And he started telling us that when he was growing up, he wanted a tattoo and he wanted to join the Marines. Then he wanted to tell us that when he turned 18, he joined the Marines, got trained as a mortarman, and was getting shipped off to Iraq, and he went into a tattoo parlor, and he had the index finger of his left hand tracing the tattoos on his right forearm. Three crosses. He said, Father, Son, Holy Ghost. But that's quite powerful. And then he said, I put them on my arms, my chest, and on my back. I wanted God to protect me. That's what he said. We went over, and he was in several terrible skirmishes, including the Battle of Fallujah, where he said you could smell death in every breath. Got out of there alive and in one piece, miraculously. And then 9 months after he returned to the States, they were shipping his unit back over again. He said he went into the tattoo parlor and had them reinforced, and that's where he showed us the drop shadows on the crosses. He said, I've been there once before. His voice is cracking, the emotion. There wasn't a dry eye in the room. He said more in that 30 minutes than he had spoken in 2 days. We very literally watched his walls come down, and his cooperation and productivity flood out. He was a different person the rest of the event because we cared enough to notice what was important to him. Now, I don't have a tattoo. I would never want a tattoo. But most of the times, the things we're going to want to notice are most likely not important to us. And if you feel a little phony or uncomfortable in the sharing, just know that when you notice something, you're being aware, and you can't fake awareness. This isn't manipulation. If you see it, you're finally noticing. Isn't that exciting? It might be uncomfortable. Now, a lot of people say to me, excuse me a moment. Sorry for those on the broadcast, didn't get the mute. Some people say to me, I do this. I look for what's good in people. I say, well, then principle number two, do you verbalize it? Oh, yeah. Well, I found that I verbalized a lot less than I saw. And I also learned this principle. What I was seeing were things that I was judging. I still remember the first time, about 97, 98, reading the scrolls. And how will I talk to people, react in only one way, with love? So when I meet somebody silently and to myself, I will say, I love you. And I talked about all these wonderful things that would happen to my facial expressions when I did it. And I'm thinking, man, guys don't do that. We just don't do that. So for the first 20 days I was studying the scroll, I didn't do it. And then the 21st day I did. I met somebody, said to them silently and to myself, I love you. And I had a giant wake-up call. I would encourage every single person on the phone tonight to do this week. When you meet somebody, silent to yourself, say, I love you. And watch the shift in their body language. Watch the difference in what you focus on. It talks about, it'll shine in my eyes and wrinkle my brow and bring a smile to my lips and echo in my voice. Part of a person's intuition is very physiological. It comes from a thing called a mirror neuron, like mirror, mirror on the wall. They reside primarily in our amygdala, our fight or flight center. Our eyes, not through the thalamus, but through the amygdala, pick up these signals, and they send messages to our body, and we have feelings before we have conscious thought. People can feel. I'm hoping you can feel tonight the love I have for each one of you. I hope you can feel the value in these principles. I hope you can feel that you don't have a need for a wall or resistance or doubt or skepticism. When we show up and we truly love, and we're really here to serve, it's discernible. We can feel it. Before we do other things to intentionally take down these walls, we take them down by just showing up, loving people. So as we're noticing what's important, add that peace. Silently to yourself, say, I love you. Instead of judging, and watch the countenance shift. We have already created a great deal of connection just by the way we show up. And I wonder if you'll learn what I learned. I'd love to hear from you. Drop me an email, davidogmandino.com. Just tell me what you find out when you do that. Just say, oh my goodness, I found out I do judge. If not, tell me what happens. I'd love to know. Because principle number one is I notice what's important. It's easier to do that if I'm truly focused on them, loving them. Agape love, a heightened level of awareness. Seeing them in the definition, Greek definition, the way God sees them. Now, we're not quite capable of doing that, but being able to see their goodness, pricelessness, without judging physical appearance, dialogue, intellect, vocabulary, all the stuff we can do. Being able to see them as priceless and unique, and then verbalizing what we see. Can we do that? Can we see the tattoos? Can we see someone's unusual beard? Can we see a car? We may not want that car. We may never want to be caught dead in that car. It's not about us. Can we see how important that car is to that person? That's not being fake or phony. That's caring enough about them to see how important it is to them. We're at the top of the hour. I want to spend one more minute. Just be with me for a moment, if you would, please. Because I want you to start doing one last thing in preparation for next week. I want you to start listening to what people say. Never. It's called doors. We call them doors. They're verbal hints about what someone's thinking. It's like, you remember the movie Phenomenon? And, CQ, CQ, you know, anybody out there, can you hear me? It's the call on a ham radio. People are going, CQ, CQ, does anybody care what's going on in here? I'm going through hell. This is awful in here. I'm discouraged and frustrated and overwhelmed, but I got to keep up this facade. How you doing? Doing great. Really, my life is not going well, but I can't say it unless I can trust that you really do care about me. So I might send a little hint out, maybe even subconsciously. Why don't you start listening for them? These little doors. Some of them are really subtle. Oh, I'm just really tired. I don't feel very good. Or it could be, aren't you listening to me? Or, how could you get involved in something like that? Everybody knows that's a scam. These are all doors. How often when those doors are caustic and hurtful, how often do we take them personally? Take that little spear in our heart. This is an August saying, just like love, or my love is my shield, to open the heart, my weapon, excuse me, to open the hearts of men, it's also my shield to repulse the arrows of hate and the spears of anger. I will turn them into the softest of rain. If we're not wearing our awareness, our agape love, I love you, silent and to myself, somebody says that to us, we're going to most likely react. We're going to justify, defend. We're going to make it all about us. If we're really aware and awake this week, and we're wearing this shield of love, and somebody says that, just step into their world. It's a big door. Walk in. Well, tell me more about that. Share with me what you're thinking. Can you hear the tone of my voice? The tone is as important as the words. It's like saying, I love you. You're important to me. You're a human being. You matter. You matter. I wonder what would cause you to say that. I wonder what kind of pain you might be experiencing. I'm curious about what's going on in your life. I'm curious. This isn't about me. I'm listening. I'm listening. I want you to see as you silently to yourself say, I love you. What do you notice this week that you haven't noticed in the past? Verbalize it. And do it until someone close to you says, are you okay? What are you doing? Actually have them notice your noticing. And then listen for those doors. Some are subtle. Some are like a baseball bat. You know, if we're not careful, they hit us up the side of the head. And we step in. Tell me more about that. Share with me what you're thinking. And just start getting into someone's world and playing with this. The instant you start noticing what's important, you become rare. The instant you verbalize it, even more rare. The instant you hear a door and you step into somebody's world, you separate yourself from 99.9% of the civilization. You are so rare. I mean, when's the last time someone actually listened to you? And last piece, and then we'll be done. When you're inside, I want you to listen. Just listen. The gift is not in fixing and giving advice. So many of us are so good at fixing and giving advice. The gift is listening, caring enough to just listen. When someone shares with you, well, share with me what you're thinking, and they share, and they finish talking, this is the last piece for tonight, I want you to count 1-1,000, 2-1,000, 3-1,000, while you're just leaning in. You're saying, is there anything else? Watch what happens. Listen to what happens. Watch them shift almost from left brain to right brain. What they tell you next may be the most important thing they share with you. I learned this lesson when I was in the film industry doing testimonial interviews. People would come, you know, the lights, the camera, the makeup artist, they'd be all nervous and scared, and you know they've been rehearsing this over and over all night long, and they sit down and you ask a question and boom, out comes a rehearsed answer. You never want to put one of those on television. Everybody can tell if it's rehearsed. It sounds corny, even if it's an actor trying to do it. You want something that comes from a different place in their heart. And when they got done, just lean in. And create a space of silent listening. Silent listening. And you could watch a shift. And what they said next was almost always what we put in the program. You want to know where someone is? You want to connect with someone? The gift is in the listening. We get to the listening by noticing what's important to them and verbalizing it. By listening for those doors and stepping into their world. Begin listening. Next week, I'm going to take you into how to create a safe place once you're inside listening. We're going to talk about how to try on their dreams, because we all want to share something when we find out, oh my goodness, what I'm doing could be so helpful, or I know exactly what to do to solve their problem. Well, there's a process we want to go through to make sure what we're about to share will be valuable. We want to make sure it's the right time. And then we want to know how to gain agreement, how to deal with objections. We're going to go through all of those pieces next week, so that you'll have all the principles for intrinsic validation, how to connect with a person at a deep and rich level, the level I believe that's required in today's world. So thanks everybody for being with us today. We begin the shift. It's a miraculous shift this week from focusing on self to focusing on others. We let go of that stuff that's in our sack. We put it in our heart, so we've got it available to us. It now makes sense. You know, our character, that which we've engraved on our heart, was forged in the furnace of adversity. We know what pain feels like. We can't take back the past, but we can use these experiences as a rich resource to more effectively connect with and serve others. And when we do, and those walls come down, the cooperation floods out, there's finally purpose in our suffering. It now has a reason. It can be used. Not something we drag around and lament and we're victims about. Now we can actually use it positively to bless another person's life. We start to experience joy in our journey. And most importantly, healing of our self-esteem. So start the process this week. Come back next week and let's get the rest of the pieces. And everything we learn from here and the rest of the qualities is all about doing this better and better and better. This is the greatest secret of success in all ventures. Last lastly spent time on Scroll 2 this week. Scroll 2, I'll greet this day with love in my heart. Agape love. This is the only scroll log had to rewrite. He wrote them all in one night, but he said, this one's a little complicated. So he just called it love. The first translation from Greek was charity. It's agape. It's a heightened level of awareness. That's what I was talking about. So let us incorporate that. As we're reading the scroll this week, I'll greet this day with love. Agape love, a heightened level of awareness. For this is the greatest secret of success in all ventures. With this, I can succeed alone. Though I have all the skills and knowledge of the world, I'll fail if I don't have this. This is the secret. Let us begin to apply it. Thanks, everyone, and thanks for sticking over just a little bit longer tonight. Such a joy to be with you. We'll be back with you next Tuesday night to celebrate life and learn the last of the principles of intrinsic validation. Good night, everyone.